And we're live.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to a very special episode of Fans of Power podcast. I'm Tyler Baker. Joe Amato is here with me. And I just have to say, it's like I've said before, I'm going to get tongue-tied trying to introduce this man that I'm so honored to be sitting and talking to here. Larry Houston has graced us with his presence again to discuss his monumental contributions to this property that we continue to celebrate all these years later. And Larry, thank you again for taking time out of your schedule to spend some more time with us and let us pick your brain about something that we hold true in our hearts.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate the interview and interview you guys for liking what we worked on back in the 80s and 90s. I'm glad you guys are, you know, you are our audience and you kept us employed. So thank you.
It's, I know we've touched on some stuff before, and I guess it's kind of like a reboot interview, but I also felt like when we talked to you the very first time about He-Man, not the X-Men interview. If you enjoy X-Men, people, we did an interview with Larry about the X-Men animated series and various other stuff, so you can check that out as well. And we kind of touched on stuff, and me and Joe afterwards, we were so starstruck after talking to you, felt like we never really got to touch the tip of the iceberg. And we really definitely wanted to focus a lot on Clash of Arms and maybe a couple of others because it's.
Did we lose Tyler? Hello?
Yeah. Oh.
But hopefully he'll pop back up in a second. Sometimes he might get a call that. Oh, there he is.
Oh, there he is. I see him a little picture of him in the bottom.
Me?
Oh, there you are.
Okay. Did I freeze up on you guys?
You disappeared.
We lost you for a quick second, but at least you're back now. So that's good.
Okay. I'm sorry. Okay. Well, what I was trying to say is that Clash of Arms is something that we've discussed a lot on the podcast and multiple times. Like it's my favorite He-Man story, period. Hands down from everything, this is the one since I was little. It's been my favorite. Joe and I have discussed it multiple times from the characters that ran it, the story itself. But, we really wanted to pick your brain on the conception of this particular comic or mini comic, you know, from its conception, you know, the script that you got, how much were you given the opportunity to improvise? I mean, just everything from the beginning to the final look of what we have here in our hands.
Yeah, I went through the through Clash of Mind. I couldn't find the writer's credit, which I, you know, every time I worked on every one of these mini comics, I always had I didn't write these things, but I would have a breakdown of what was supposed to happen. And I also had like, you know, who said what, and but I really never had a direction like you need to do a down shot here, a long shot, a medium close up and all that. They pretty much left it all up to me. I just basically got a script with the dialogue and where the characters need to be. And so it was up to me to take what they had written and pace it out. Like, okay, I know how to get the characters from point A to point B based upon all of my experience in animation. And so that's what I would do. Basically, you know, if they, like the beginning had the guy on the horse, and then, you know, there's, according, you know, I'm looking at the book, right here. And then, you know, the guys come and they're going to attack him from behind. And so it was just a matter of me going ahead and just making the pacing correct. And I just basically, I was a fan of Jack Kirby. I'm a fan of John Buscema, basically a lot of Marvel guys. And using that plus working in animation, storyboarding G.I. Joe and Transformers and all the other Hasbro toys, I just kind of took that training and put it into the stories that I was working on. It was kind of fun. The fun part was that it was almost like, I guess in my mind, I was kind of like, I felt like I was working at Marvel Comics, drawing a Marvel comic book. And it's like, well, if I was really drawing at those studios, you know, how would it look like? And I just basically started having fun and pacing it as if it was a Marvel comic book, but also remembering that it's going to be shrunk real small. So I had to make sure that's where my training in animation came from. It's like, okay, I have to make sure the story is very clear. And I had to come up with layouts and compositions that would shrink and still tell the story well. So it's kind of like a taking like that entire situation, make a big soup, and that's what I did when I created the storyboard. When I created the mini comics.
Now, like when you're creating the composition, everything, I mean, are there a lot of changes based on what we've gotten in the final book? I mean, are you changing the layout? Like, I mean, are they attacking from different positions, or is Fisto doing something different? I mean, is it pretty much what you initially are setting out in like rough sketches and layouts, or are you kind of tweaking this and changing this as you go along, or do you have a good idea as you're going along what you want to do?
Well, for me, what I would do, read the entire script and get an idea of where the entire script was going. And then in my mind, I could figure out the pacing, because there are certain parts of the story that it doesn't need a huge amount of drawing, because you're trying to get through the dialogue or you're trying to set up a situation. And I tried to pace it with like smaller panels so that when I got to the fights, I could have like almost an entire page to do the choreographing the fights between one character and another. And so a lot of times you see like the smaller panels were just to get the move the story forward, so that when I could have the fights between, like when He-Man was fighting Skeletor, or like in this situation when he's in the middle of the arena fighting these other guys, I wanted those to be big panels, so it will be very exciting, you know, as exciting as I can make it.
Yeah, because that's what I was wondering about this. I mean, this comic, it's, as you said, and as a lot of people know, this isn't one that was focused really around He-Man. This is around Fisto and a lot of the other, you know, villains, which you didn't see that too much in any of the other mini comics. Right. And the way, like you were saying earlier, how you paced it was great, because you were able to show how Clawful, you know, had time to shine in his fight against Fisto, you know, Jitsu's, you know, there, but you had Whiplash just basically, we loved it because I was like, man, it looked like Whiplash would have killed Fisto if it wasn't for He-Man coming in the end. And that's what I was wondering, was like, did they give you the specific order of like, okay, we want you to first have Clawful before Whiplash? Did you, you know, try to say, hey, maybe we could have this guy before the other? I always wondered like the order of how things go, because it worked beautifully.
Yes.
No, the when characters came in and came out, like when He-Man came at the end, was all based upon what the script said. I just tried to make the combat, you know, he wasn't going to be a pushover, so I tried to make him like, you know, he can hold his own. He's got muscles, he's got strength, he's got skills. Just wanted to play it up as if he was like a character from Marvel, like a Hercules or Thor.
Okay, you know? Yeah.
That he could hold his own and just, you know, he could kick butt, you know, and it was a good chance, you know, this was a good chance to have some fun with a character other than He-Man for one issue.
Yes, and that's what shows. I mean, like I said, this is one of the best stories too. I mean, and plus, like you said, your layout and everything you did just showed the battles can tell a story. You know, sometimes you don't need tons of dialogue, and that's what showed in this. But also the other thing that was like really kind of, I guess, noticeable in this is at the end when He-Man does finally make his appearance, you know, he's wielding a gun. Now, was that also in the script, or did you decide to, like, you know, switch things up and give him the gun for something different, or was that possibly in the script as well?
No, that was in the script. When they give me a script, I try to follow the script as much as possible, but if the script is kind of weak or maybe it needs tweaking, I will change things, but I'll try and keep the essence of what the writer wrote, but I'll just try and kick up the action a notch, try to make it more interesting than what maybe was written. But no, that wasn't a script of him having a ray gun. So okay. Yeah, I didn't make it up.
All right. Yeah, I was always curious about it because it's so noticeable, you know, and different. You know, we're always used to seeing He-Man with the sword, and in this story not only didn't focus on He-Man, but when he made his appearance, he doesn't even have his sword, he has a gun, but it's cool. Like I said, that's what makes it memorable, you know. But I'll pass it to Tyler. But yeah, this is pretty much one of the best mini comics that anybody could look at and read, but definitely to look at. It's beautiful.
It definitely is the best. And I can't hammer that. I'm sorry, Larry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I, you know, when, you know, with He-Man with the gun, I just tried to find a nice, you know, Dirty Harry type, you know, pose with the imposing gun, you know, above the head. And,
yeah,
you know, just trying to make everything look cool, like a real, you know, Marvel comic book.
Now, I know, and we all know you're a big Marvel fan, and I mean, when you're working on these mini comics, I mean, look at Logan showing off his awesome collection. I hope fans can see that there. With
yeah, I was just moving around.
Oh man, so he's like an evil supervillain showing off his mighty collection in the back there. He knows what he's doing.
Fanning it around, it's like being in a store. It's awesome,
man.
Go ahead.
The fights and things. Are you like? What is it that you're? I mean, I guess another way of putting this is that when you're giving these mini comics and they want you to use these characters, how are you? Because one of my favorite panels or favorite is the second page where you see all four evil warriors charging at Fisto and Jitsu leaps and karate chops, and you got the other three attacking Stridor. Are you looking at the action figures and kind of assuming, okay, this guy looks like he might do this, or are they giving you how they, you know, I know the story's telling you one thing, but are you looking at the toys? Are you coming up with your own ideas on how to depict these villains? Because as an artist, you're picking very good poses to show how dominant they are. And I'm just curious what your ideas on making that process?
Yeah, basically, no, they have to give me the toys and give me an idea of what each figure can do, what can they do in the story, other than what I, you know, what would be obvious. And once I have that, it's pretty much, I go ahead and say, okay, I just kind of pace out what each character could do. And I just pace it out like as if it was a Marvel comic book. And I try to just draw the best dynamic composition possible. And it's basically where all of my style comes from. I just try and make everything I'm working on dynamic, you know, like as if it was a movie, a comic book. My main thing when I do, when I was doing these comic book pages, because like I said, I knew it was going to shrink, is my style is that I like to try and tell a story as best as possible without words. So if you took out all the words in the comic book, can you tell what's going on? And that's one of my precepts that I gave myself, that I tried to incorporate that into my style, so that if you took out all the word balloons, can you figure out what's going on? And that's, I like clarity of action, clarity of composition, and you know, using the Jack Kirby way of like foreground, mid-ground, background, layering the shots, and you know, trying to be as forceful as you can to making the show dynamic, you know. And then,
I'm sorry, I was gonna say, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but you're saying it beautifully of how you said this is telling a story like you don't even have to really see the dialogue to really know what's going on. And that's something that, you know, you didn't see in many comics, but especially sometimes even in like current comics. Like, they're so focused on talking so much in these comics that you wondered, well, what would be going on if they weren't saying stuff? Like, they're standing here, they're doing this. It's like there's nothing exciting, but you captured it beautifully, as you said, because you can look at this, see what's going from beginning to end, and you wouldn't even need the words. The words, sure, they're, you know, icing on the cake, I guess. But, I mean, just to see the intensity of when Whiplash is having that battle with Fisto, and you see him, you know, thwack him, and then, you know, you had that scene where Whiplash is having his tail come down at Fisto, and Fisto catches it, and you beautifully, in the next panel, had Whiplash use his tail to bang him on the ground. It's like, it's intense. That's what you get out of your comics, and especially this one, is intensity in the drawings, which is something sorely lacking, it seems like, nowadays. But thank God you did just amazing pieces.
Well, thank you. When I would hire people to work for me on my shows, when I was directing these shows, one of the things I would do when they gave me their storyboards is I would just take their examples of their work, and I would just flip through the storyboards page by page to see if I could track the story without having to read the dialogue captions underneath. And so that was my criteria, because that's kind of how I learned how to do it, to tell stories. There was a lot of anime cartoons coming into America in about, for me, it was about 1980. And there was a guy named Miyazaki who was superb at storyboarding action. But because I didn't know the language, it was all in Japanese. I had no idea what the hell he was saying, but he was so good at telling a story. It really made a huge impression on me and helping me to define my style of being able to tell the story as clearly as you can, you know, and the only thing necessary is dialogue for subtext or for characterization. And so that's one of the things I incorporated to my style, is trying to do that in either animation or in the comic books. Is I want to tell the story with that kind of clarity. And so that was one of the things I incorporated into my style. And so that's when he was, you know, when he's fighting the guys, I just try to make sure that, like, you know, if there's no words, you know who's winning and you know who's losing.
Right.
Like with the fight with Clawful, which, you know, when I got this when I was about 3 years old, this book left such an impression on me of how you depicted the villains. And I didn't have a lot of these villains, and I wouldn't get them until I was a little bit older. And it was so impressionable. I mean, it really was. Even as a kid, villains were just, they would really stick out, and that's what made He-Man so great, was the villains especially.
Yeah.
And your depiction of Clawful has single-handedly been my favorite since I was little, aside from any cartoon, any other interpretation I've seen it in other medias. It's this one, this look, this aggressive style that you gave him, that, I mean, where the character just reeks of evil. And what, I mean, and I'm sure it probably just comes naturally to you, but when you're drawing these characters, I mean, did you really like Clawful a lot? Because I know it may have been the story, but he really shines so much in this book. And I mean, everything from every posed, like from punch and his, like him standing hovering over Fisto, I mean, you really hammer it home that you're playing this guy up as, I mean, a force to be reckoned with. And for me, as a child, I'm looking at it, I'm still in awe.
I don't know. Thank you. I don't know what to say. I just, when I saw the character in his claws, I could see the acting and action that I could pace based upon the dialogue. Because the dialogue wasn't that much, but I saw how I could make it as exciting as I wanted to. You know, I'm looking at it right now going,
yes,
oh, yeah, I did that. I did this. And, no, it was just fun. That's one of the things that's also missing sometimes from some of these books is that, you know, having fun drawing these characters, drawing the action. I guess I grew up in a time when the best of times, because my inspiration, like I said, comes from like some key artists that really inspired me to be a better person, a better artist. And, you know, their work had so much influence on my style. I mean, I'm nowhere near as good an artist as they are. And I'm not the best, I'm not the worst, but I do know how to tell a story really well. And so that's what I put forth in these books, is just to use that skill that I acquired, that's my style, and just use it as to the best I can and just have some fun with it. And, you know, I'm really appreciative that that you, like people like yourself, that you like what I did, because you got to remember back then there's no internet, there's no likes, you know, you kind of shooting stuff in the dark. You have no idea if anybody likes what you do or not. And it wasn't until way later that I started finding out people like yourself kind of like the books I did. And I was like, oh, that's nice. I had no idea, you know.
Well, we definitely loved them because, I mean, when it comes to Masters of the Universe fans, you know, we didn't have much, meaning, of course, yes, we had the cartoon and we had the set amount of mini comics and we had some Star Marvel, but it's like things didn't continue for years and years and years. So we're very hungry when it comes to like what we have. We enjoy what we got. And when there's something that really shines, it's definitely noticeable. And as for you, you're responsible for working on more. of the vintage Masters of the Universe mini comics than any of the artists. You drew more than any of them, because sometimes people think, hey, this guy might have did more. It's like, wait a second, Larry did this and this and this and this. You're also responsible for some of the most original and unique looking characters, because like you said, I mean, we have so many different new characters in your stories. That's what's great. I mean, you have kobolds, you know, the kobolds, which are those one creatures you drew. You have, right. Yeah, that's, I mean, yeah, them, which people, the fans out there, that they're starting to want figures of them, because we got Lodar finally, which is, yes, fantastic.
Yes, seen him, Larry.
Right there. See,
oh, Larry, look at that.
Yeah.
Wow, I've never seen him before.
Yeah, well, that was something I told Joe. I said, we get Larry on, we got to make sure he sees Lodar.
If fans were hungry for that, Larry, they wanted Lodar. We got
the spikes on his boots. I mean, he's in beautiful shape. I mean, just absolutely wonderful.
And Geldor, you got to bring up Geldor too.
Yeah, and I got the chains here too, just like you drew on the cover.
Oh my God, the ones that got me in trouble.
Yeah, for the cover. Yeah, exactly.
See, let me get Geldor here for him too.
That's what I mean. So you know, we've already had two of your unique visioned of characters turned into figures, and there's still plenty more from Prince Daycon. We have Baron,
Eldor, not get the secret.
Oh, wow, look at him! Wow,
yeah, you figure, like, my God, you figure that Mattel would have contacted you or something, said, hey, look what we made. Yeah. You know,
he got his trademark axe there too that you drew for him, so he is in his absolute badass glory here.
Wow, that is looking good.
Yeah,
that's what we'd love.
They captured his face and everything that you drew. They made sure that these figures depicted everything you drew perfectly, and they're very well received. And fans still want Prince Daycon.
Yes,
your version of Garn, the Native American version.
Yes,
right.
Him. They want the kobolds. I mean, there's. I mean, like I said, you're responsible for some of the most unique and original characters in all the mini comics. And every time polls come up, people are wanting what you gave us. And that's why it's just your mind. I always wondered, I've said it before, it's like, I love how you just created so many different versions and visions of characters and creatures. It's like, you know, when I was telling you about, you know, the big time demon that I think you drew in one of them, and then the other creature that you had that had like that kind of brain, but I think he spoke. I don't know if it ever had a name. And was that in Tyler? Which one was that with the blue demon that had like a brain and it kind of was showing it?
Yeah, it was kind of like a throwaway. It was a throwaway monster that I just kind of made up, because he was blocking He-Man's way, so he tied his hands and kicked him in the head, and then he kept going.
Well, it's memorable. That's what I mean. Either way, everything you did, that's just so damn memorable, because it's not stuff we were seeing in the cartoons or other mini comics. Every single vision. I love, like I said, the method to everything you do. And it's I just can't believe still that you never knew that they made those figures, that they wouldn't even have contacted you to say, hey, Larry, we made figures based off of your creations. That still blows my mind that they wouldn't have contacted you on that at some point.
Yeah, no, pretty much the way it worked was that Lee Norling was the guy who was my contact. He was the in-between between the toy company and me. So Lee Norling would hire us to work on the show. He would hire the writer, the letterer, and he'd be like the person coordinating all the different artists working on the show. So I really, you know, Mattel only saw Lee. He never saw us. And they pretty much left Lee up with his, using his expertise. I had known Lee for a couple of years. And so when he called me up to be an artist on the show, I said, sure, yeah, that sounds like fun. I, you know, my friends were still working on He-Man, the cartoon show. And so I got a chance to, even though I didn't work on a cartoon show, I got a chance to do the comic books. It was like, yeah, this will be fun, you know.
And yeah, because that's the great thing, again, is you were able to represent so many different cultures and races, which is something that you, which is something you, again, didn't see in the comics too often or in the cartoon. So now, was that all from you as well, or did they tell you they wanted somebody that maybe to be of Asian descent or any other culture, or, you know, like certain creatures? Was that just you?
That was me. Basically, like the stories, those characters, I'm pretty much trained. When I was working on G.I. Joe and Transformers, the first thing I asked for was, I need a copy of the toys. I need copies of this and that. And those characters that they made up, they had nothing. You know, the writer just made up something. So I talked to Lee. I said, would it be okay if I make up the stuff? And he said, yeah, sure. So I kind of just made up, you know, a good black guy and a bad black guy, and just had some fun with it. And when it was, when we turned it into, or when Lee turned it into the company, you know, they seemed to like it. So the next time we got a another script, I got another script. So I asked Lee, I said, I mind if I make him Asian? So I said, no, no, go ahead. So I made him Asian. The next group, I think I made him American Indian. I just started trying to expand the culture of He-Man. So there are like, to, so people would know there are other tribes of people on his world.
And that's and what just, I love. I love that you did that. Like, especially with Garn, for example, the one that you made, you know, like you said, Native American, you know, the big Indian. But in the cartoon, he was African American. And I always thought, I didn't know which, like, I didn't know if you knew Tyler or if you even knew that. I was like, which came first? But I thought that's great because we have a unique character playing the same role, but of two different races. It's fantastic. You know, it's, I didn't know which, like I said, which came first.
Something that I we mentioned in the first interview we did with Larry, and that's something and maybe Larry can elaborate a little bit more on your connection with Filmation, because you had done Double-Edged Sword and Slave City, which also happened to be episodes in the cartoon, except instead of Slave City, it was Tale of Two Cities, where Garn was a black man, and instead of Lodar, you had Queen Belina, who was black, and her wizard, Raka, who was black also. And then you've got Double-Edged Sword. Instead of an Asian grandfather, an Asian young man, you've got a white grandfather and a white young man. But the stories were very similar. And I remember I didn't know what the connection was. And maybe it was just coincidence that, you know, you worked on too many comics that were also Filmation episodes. Right. And there's a cultural expansion, which I've always found was quite fascinating to see other ethnicities in He-Man. And that was something that always caught my, even as a kid, when I got Secret Liquid of Life, Gyaldor really stuck out to me. You know, I couldn't read, but it was just, who is this? You know, it's a different kind of adventure. And it was so interesting to me. So is there a connection, or is this just all great coincidence pretty much?
I would say it's more of a great coincidence, because I, like I said, when I got the script, I had no model sheets, no nothing. So you'd have to go back in the timeline to see did the script I get, was it before Filmation or after Filmation? I don't know. I'm not sure which chicken or egg happened, but I had no references, no model sheets, no toys. So I pretty much had a run of just making it up as I went along. And I just decided on my own to, you know, add more ethnic characters and tribes to the world. He said it was cool. I went, okay, I'll do that. So I'll just, you know, in an animation at that time in the 80s, you know, they were worried about stereotypes. So, you know, the thing was in animation, as long as you show like a good black person and a bad black person, it's fine. You know, and you do it with every group. You do it for Asians and American Indians and whatever. Just show one of each and you're good to go, you know? And so that's what I was doing.
That is, it's interesting you said that. I don't know if you knew Michael Reeves, who worked on a bunch of the animated series. He said in an interview that Jitsu, who you drew in Clash of Arms, showed up in one episode of the He-Man cartoon, and he says in the interview that his concern was that he was Asian, and if the staff's going to have an issue depicting this Asian character as a villain.
Right.
And I was wondering, you know, I mean, is that, where was it? Now I forgot where I was going with that. I mean, I guess the concern, you know, that, you know, which kind of felt like, you know, was that a real big concern back then? I mean, that you couldn't have, or I guess you kind of stated that as long as you depicted,
depicted one of each in animation, you were good to go. So you can have a bad one, you have a good one. So you're not doing a stereotype showing. You know, you're showing the, you know, good and bad. So,
would they necessarily be within the same story, or could there have been multiple stories depicting, you know, an evil Asian character and a good Asian character in another episode? Or would it work better for the powers that be that need to be in the same story?
It would work best to be in the same story, because the critics at the time may not see the other episode. So,
gotcha.
If you do it in one episode, you know, you're covered. And if you only do the bad Asian in one episode, now you got to explain, you're not trying to stereotype him, because you got to look at episode 17. There's a good one over here. It's like, man, that doesn't work.
Let me ask you this then too. Do you have other ideas for expanding the ethnicity in He-Man? Like, I've always been a fan of the Shaka Zulu miniseries, and there's a painting in the He-Man magazine of He-Man on Earth with a character that looked a lot like Shaka Zulu. And I just thought, God, that would be so cool to see a warrior, either a hero or a villain, that would resemble, you know, the real life Shaka Zulu, or at least how he was depicted in the miniseries.
Right.
And it's just like, I would love to have seen something like that. Did you have other ideas of making other, you know, evil and heroic warriors, you know, more black characters, more Asian characters, more Native American, or, you know, did you have other ideas that you would have loved to have seen or put in the stories?
Yeah, I had a lot more designs I was going to use for the show if I could have kept going. One of the reasons I had to stop was that my workload at Marvel Productions, because I was working at Marvel Productions, storyboarding in the daytime, and then doing the He-Man at night. And I was also doing He-Man, G.I. Joe t-shirts for this apparel company. So I was doing that. Yeah, so I did a lot of apparel t-shirts of these G.I. Joe characters. I think I did four of them. And I was, I was young. I could burn the midnight oil as much as possible, but I can't do that anymore. But what happened, why I stopped, was because I got promoted from being a storyboard artist to being a director on G.I. Joe. One of the directors left. I got a shot site. I got a promotion. And suddenly I went from just being a storyboard artist to being in charge of the entire show. And I just ran out of time. So I had to set aside some of my freelance. So that, unfortunately, He-Man was one of them. So I had to put it aside because I had so much to do. Being a director, you know, when you're doing a storyboard artist, I get a script, I draw it, turn it in, that's it. But when you're the director, I got to look at everybody else's storyboards. Plus, I got to go through and correct all the boards if they have mistakes. I have to go through and double check dialogue. I have to do timing. I have to double check the color department. I have to make sure there's no show's not too long. I got to time the show. I got to cut the show. I got to get prepped for going overseas to Japan. I just ran out of time working on my freelance He-Man because of the duties I had to do on G.I. Joe. So that was unfortunate because I was having a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, we were too. Could you imagine if things played out in a different reality? We had more mini comics from Larry Houston and more original characters. Like, I don't know if we could be able to withstand that kind of stuff. I mean, there's just so much you've done, which I guess leads me to another thing is, you know, we know, like you said, you did a lot of different drawings here and there, but is it possible that, do you have any characters that maybe you drew out, we're going to maybe throw in there as a different background character, unique character that didn't make it in the mini comic that maybe it's somewhere lost? Because I guess it could lead to, I can only imagine if we had the art of Larry Houston, of all the stuff you did for Masters. I mean, trust me, Larry, fans will buy it up. We love buying art books, but that's what I mean. Is there any lost stuff, some things that just didn't make it that you drew? Unique things, other characters?
There have sketches that were put aside a long time ago. If they were going to give me another show with another script with random monsters, I had sketched up, you know, some random monsters that I could use, that I try not to repeat myself. So I tried to come up with something different every time to try and, so it didn't look the same all the time. I try and always challenge myself back then to
always do something. And do you still have these sketches by chance? Would you still have them if a book was to come? Maybe crossing fingers.
I probably do, but they're in storage. Everything's in storage. I still have some of the original comic book pages from the He-Man comic books I've been discovering as I go through my storage unit, that I'm probably just going to put up for sale somewhere to see if any of you guys like it.
Larry, you're getting our hearts pumping and going. You're getting us a little
Jesus. First dibs on whatever you got now. God, can you give us a description of some of the maybe evil and heroic characters that you'd possibly come up with just for fun sketches, like an idea, like a, you know, did you come up with like a evil wizard? Did you come up with like a guy with a spiked arm or something? I mean, what did you, do you have anything right off the top of your head? Like,
it was mainly designs and costuming and, what if, you know, strong guys, tall guys, monsters, you know, I was trying not to repeat myself. So it's like, you know, different types of variations on a theme. But they were all sketches because basically I knew that for the most part, working for Mattel, they're always going to give you their toys. So you just, you know, draw what they tell you to draw. It's only if the writer writes some random stuff, it's like, okay, what do I put here? You know, so you just...
Larry, I'm telling you, we gotta. If there's the powers that be that we could get you in contact with, because I'm not exaggerating when saying if you were able to take all your sketches of things that we haven't seen, and of course things we have seen, but maybe, you know, without text or however it may be, and that was put into a book. I mean, we already have people in the chat room right now saying, "Yeah, we buy them." Trust me, they would buy this book. I mean, it's a no brainer. I mean, it's a cash cow. We have been buying so many as of late. I didn't know if there's something else you didn't know, but there's been a lot of Art of He-Man books, mini comic collection, a lot of things that Dark Horse has been putting out. Everyone they put out, fans. I mean, like I said, we're rabid. We have nothing. So when we see stuff that we haven't seen before or stuff we love into a big volume, we go for it. And I'm telling you, you put your stuff that you're talking about and somehow get in contact with them, that'd be in a book. I mean, it would be selling like gangbusters. And that's not me just hyping it up. It's no doubt. I mean, I do a hype man thing, as people say. They hear how I talk. But trust me, it would sell like crazy. And I don't know if that's something that anybody's ever contacted you about. But believe me, if somebody got you in contact with the right people that are putting out these books, it's a gold mine. It really is a gold mine.
Okay, well, if I do find it, I'll make sure to contact Tyler and you and just let you guys know what it is, and you guys can tell me who would like to see it.
Absolutely. God, I mean, that's just to see your ideas. I mean, almost like that fans have helped contribute to naming characters and ensuring prototypes that were just ideas and thoughts that have been released to the, you know, on the internet have been made into figures, so... I mean, it would be awesome to see a lot of your characters, I mean, come to fruition. And I mean, it's you've made such a giant contribution in so many ways. I mean, we just have so much fun being fanboys, just talking about this and that. And speaking of one of your biggest contributions, do you remember drawing the Powers of Grayskull, The Legends Begins mini comic with all the dinosaurs?
Yes, I do. Yes. I think my friend, the producer of Batman, Bruce Timm, inked my stuff.
Yes. Now, can you elaborate? Because it looks like you got to have a field day of designing a whole world of you know, mechanical-looking dinosaurs based on just the three toys that were depicted. But, you know, there's a big splash page of an assortment of other dinosaurs. And I'm sure you being, you know, loving to have fun with your books... I mean, seeing the snake man attacking your village, you got a giant snake. Yes.
Is this it? Let's see. No, this isn't it. This is somebody else's.
Oh, yeah, that's somebody else's. Yeah, that's a different one.
That's the one we won't speak of. Yours is the real one.
Yeah.
Oh. We'll keep it real. I'm just being honest. That's it, yeah.
Okay, yeah, I've seen it, but I don't have it handy. Yeah, I don't have it handy, but I do remember drawing that and having some fun with it. Yeah,
that is right there, Larry. That one
talking about for you.
I had to jump in real quick. I just want to say you're responsible also for drawing one of the most iconic books that I looked at as a kid like crazy, because I was expecting part two and three and we never got it. And that was the first part. But I just looked at that beautiful art and that comic over and over. And you're also responsible for the biggest cliffhanger of a character in history. How you drew Hero at the end in all shadowed out. And we never got to see what this guy looked like. And it just had us, you know, just chomping and, you know, waiting. What's he going to look like? Who is this character? And we never got to see it. But see, I didn't know like how much, like you said, you remember about the whole process. But as for Hero, since he was going to be part of like a new line and a new character, do you remember when they told you about this character? Did they specifically say don't draw them at all or do a shadowed out image? Or like, what was your inspiration? Because Tyler could probably get up that image to show you of that, just so you could like get a little a refresher.
Yeah, right there is the shattered hero that you drew.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What the only thing I remember them telling me was that he was going to be have the same a similar physique as He-Man, but not to show what he looked like, and that's the only guidance I got. And so that's where all that came from.
Beautiful so, damn teaser! Beautiful damn teaser!
Oh, it was. And did they even show you what Hero was going to look like, or they that's it? They just gave you the description, and that's it. That's all you were given.
That's all I was given.
Wow!
So I kind of made it up.
It looks awesome. And this was one of the last ones that was done. So I guess as you're working on G.I. Joe, are you kind of casually coming back and working for Mattel here and there freelancing? Because this one came out in 87. And, you know, like Clash of Arms came out in 84 and you did some in 85. So are you coming back and forth, or are they throwing you a bunch at once, or how is your schedule? With that.
I think it was more along that I had to take a hiatus away to because of my duties at Marvel Productions. And I think Lee approached me sometime later to do that issue that it's like, okay, yeah, I remembered it fondly. It's like, yeah, I'd like to have another shot at it. So that's what that was. And but yeah, they never did another one. It was like, okay. You know, one of the things I tried to do with the mini comics also is there's an artist named Jack Kirby who loved to do like one page spreads, two page spreads. And so that's the kind of fun I wanted to do with the He-Man, with the mini comics, is that I tried to pace the story so that, you know, somewhere like where the place where I thought the staple was going to be in the book, I could do a continuous two-page spread where it would work. Or, you know, I tried to time it so that I could get two pages in there. And that was one of the things I remember that I tried to put in the He-Man books that I thought would be fun for people to see, like the big combat scenes or whatever. That I do remember deliberately trying to pace out the stories to get those in there.
Yeah, because I was going to say about the pacing of that, because one of the people in the chat room, Eric Amon, his question was about, he said, what instruction were you given with regard to the length of the mini comics? Was it based on the number of pages or panels? Because was there always a set amount of, you got 14 pages to work with, go? Or like, how did that work?
Oh, no, yeah, the page count for the books were set. And so it was up to me to pace it. I would get a script and they would have dialogue and places that they're supposed to be, like locations. And pretty much after that, it was up to me to do everything else. So it was all me. I just kind of like would figure out how to pace the story, and the stuff that was less dynamic but necessary to move the story forward, I would try and use smaller panels. And then when you get to action, you know, go start making the big panels and have some fun with it.
Okay. All right. No.
Larry, real quick, Joe. I have, since we're on this one.
Okay.
You recognize this guy, Larry?
Oh my God! was that a real toy?
Yes, yeah, they made that too.
This is made by Mattel. Yeah, you're disguised He-Man from this story.
Yeah, I think I don't know if they call them Preternia disguised He-Man, but yes, exactly.
The eye piece and everything. Because I was going to ask you about your conception for this disguise, which, you know, is quite celebrated. He's even got a gun that's reminiscent of the Bionitops gun that you
drew. Oh yeah, see that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. I had never seen that before.
This new classics line is celebrating everything. And like I said, when it came to mini comics, you pretty much, I think more of your original designs have been turned into toys than any of the others so far. And there's still so many more that should be made. But yeah, this is the new classics line that's been out for the past, maybe, what has it been? Maybe 10 years, Tyler? 9, 10 years?
Over 10 years. And I mean, this was an exclusive figure. Like, you had to sign up for the sub just to get this figure. So this was...
Wow.
And it was a heavily sought after figure. I was so I'm still sitting over here in the front row on my variant shelf.
And what did they? What's his name?
They call it Pre-Eternia Disguised He-Man.
Oh,
yeah,
because he came from Pre-Eternia, so that's yeah.
Yeah.
Now, what was your idea about this design? You know, I mean, it's a simplistic design, but boy, is it memorable. I mean, did you play around with this? Was it heavy in the script, like his disguise, what it was supposed to look like, or?
No, I think at the time when I came up with something like that, it was based, God, I'm trying to remember back now. When we were, I can't remember if it was inspired by a single character, but I remember, it might have been inspired by something that when I was working on G.I. Joe, it might have been some monks I was working on when I was working on G.I. Joe. And that kind of disguise works really well for disguising a character. But, you know, if you want to, since they told me it was like a He-Man type character with his physique, that's why I opened the arm so you could get the musculature, yeah. You know, so you can tell like, hey, this is a badass guy, but you know, who is he, you know, hide him with the hoodie and stuff, you know?
And the eyepiece, it kind of looks like Kato's mask and Green Hornet almost. You know,
the Yeah. I didn't want them to paint any eyes, eye color, you know, I didn't want any of that. So that's why I tried to put all that stuff in it to try and really disguise the character. Because, you know, they never told me what it was. So it's like, I'm going to make this guy as mysterious as possible, you know?
Now, so, they're given these stories. I mean, and I know, I imagine, especially if you're trying to get these done in a certain time frame, is it more frustrating to not have much of a description, or is it more, do you have more freedom, you know, from a creative standpoint that you'd almost prefer they not give you a specific description? That way you can really play around and have fun with it, or do you look at it like, I need to get this done, can you give me something more specific?
It's kind of equal for me, because it's like, it's actually easier if they give me a toy, but it's actually more restricting, because then I got to take the toy and figure out, okay, now how can I depict him being like a super badass? Because I got to figure out how is his claw, his tail, or, you know, how can I make it as formidable as possible? If they left it to my own imagination, I can come up with something really cool and just, hey, this guy's going to try and kick his ass, and how's He-Man going to beat this guy? So I guess maybe I prefer my own, because I can have some fun with it.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I was going to say, was there any particular, whether it be a good guy or a bad guy, that when you were told the description of, or what a particular character looked like that already existed, did you find it maybe difficult to do a certain one? Like, let's say, okay, you have Clawful, Stinkor, Whiplash, Jitsu. I mean, like, characters like that. Was there one that you thought, man, how can I make this guy look bad? How can I make him look wicked or come across that? You know, because, like, even, like, Stinkor, you know, it's like, we didn't get him in the cartoon. We basically got him, you know, in the comics. So we think, okay, how can I make him look wicked? Was he difficult at all? Or
Stinkor wasn't, but the character I thought was challenging was the, forgive me, I can't remember his name, but there was a character that could break up into these different parts.
Oh, Modulok.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. It's like I have to draw him all over the place. It's like, like, it's not, you know, one person versus one. It's like one person versus like four. And it's like, oh, shit, I got to figure out how to do this. It was a little challenging, you know.
Yeah.
Because you're just not drawing one adversary. You're drawing four pieces attacking and figure out how to make it work.
I've always said that. I've still told people, I said, that is probably my favorite Modulok, because he's more just, he looks more frightening, grotesque. He's small, the way he, you know, like you said, how you have him popping into different things. But his look is always like, this is the mask I wear. This is Modulok's mask, just in case you're wondering what the hell I'm wearing. So, but this is a Filmation Modulok. But your Modulok, yeah, is probably my favorite. And it's, I'd still hope that one day we could get a figure of that version, because it's quite unique and different. It is definitely different from the cartoon and from the toy.
Okay, yeah, I had it on the wall here. Yeah, this guy here.
Oh, yes. Love it. Love that little gun. because I even said, now I don't know, like, inspiration, like if you had any inspiration for him, because the one thing I used to compare it to, at least the one head, not the one with like kind of like the mask look, you know, on the, you know, the one head, but the just right. the plain naked one. Well, it reminded me of a horror movie that was back in the day called The Ghoulies, these little creatures.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
And I was like, I wonder if that was kind of inspiration because he kind of looks like a ghoulie creature, but I love it. It's still unique, but I didn't know if you had inspiration for when you did these little demented son of a guns.
No, I didn't inspire from The Ghoulies, but I tried to make these little, you know, he breaks up these parts. I tried to make it look as fearsome as I could. You know, it's like,
you did.
I'm trying to make him look. Hey, he might be small and short, but he's formidable. There's a whole bunch of things he could do, and that's what I was trying to make, you know, trying to make him. He's not a pushover, that kind of stuff.
No, definitely, it's one creature you wouldn't want to come across, but
I tried to. Oh, okay, I'm not doing it right, but anyway, yeah, I tried to, yeah, just try and. Make him exciting, you know. Oh, let me hold this phone right. There it is. Okay. I Modulok was, to the best of my memory, that one was challenging. The guy with the smell, stinky smell. Stinkor was he was in a comic book, it's very easy to draw because you just draw the smell lines. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to depict in a comic book. It's a lot harder to depict in animation. So, but comic book is real easy to have some fun with them.
To signify those smell lines, like even if when you did Mossman, which was like the counter to Stinkor, Mossman was the good smelling one, the green looking character, if you remember him.
Yes, I do.
So he was the other one that you could, I guess, do an aura to represent, because like the battle they had with their smells. I was always wondering, you know, like, how do you do that? How do you have to fight with smells? You know, how's it come across? But you made it work.
Yeah, I don't remember. Do you remember what issue that was?
Wait, that was the Stench of Evil.
Yeah, it's this one here. If you have this comic, The Stench of Evil.
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, here it is. Yeah, I got one here. There okay. it is. Yeah, okay.
Because yeah, you have them shooting with their energy, and like in the one panel, like towards the end, when Stinkor is trying to shoot a stink at him, Mossman puts up like a barrier, an aura of his smell to like prevent getting hit from it. So,
there it is. I'm looking at what I drew.
Because I wondered, I was like, did he find that challenging having to have these two engage with, you know, smells? You know, like, you know, of course they get physical, which you did beautifully and perfect too. But I was like, I always wondered how weird that was to have characters with smells have a fight.
Yeah. Well, it was, I'm looking at the drawings here, and it's like, it's clarity of, and luckily I told the colorist to really make sure the colors don't blend in. Like, you know, his would be purple and the other one was green. I'm looking at it here. So I remember telling them they have to be distinctive in order so that people know whose order it is. Whose stink it is, you know.
One's got purple stink, the other's got the green stink, but no, I got you.
Yeah. And so for me, it was kind of like I tried to imagine the auras as if they were like maybe energy fields. And then play with it that way.
I got it.
Yeah, and that's kind of how I did it back then. Was think of it that way.
Now, when you're given these figures, and you drew them all fantastic. Now, do you ever have a hard time? You're looking at them. Do you kind of? Did you ever kind of like kind of? That's a villain. You know? Do you? Oh. I mean, has it ever been? Struggle with any of the characters you drew to? I mean, obviously you made them all look badass, but you know, as from an artist, you kind of sit there and you're like, how do I depict this guy and make him look like he's a formidable villain here? You know, or are they all?
Everyone had a different challenge, but you know, if a lot of the existing toys already had like people had a serious scowl, which was pretty easy to deal with, you know, pretty easy to run with. So is most of the villains were easy to run with. You know, I tried to make even like we were saying, you were saying before, I tried to make Modulok, you know, look really, oh man, this is, you know, this guy's really gonna tear you apart. I think more so than the TV show, because they had they got you know, television people looking at them, and they really have to, I won't say walking on eggshells, but they have to be more careful than I had to be in drawing the comic books.
Yeah, because you're right with that. With the mini comics, they seemed like they would have more of a serious tone and look to them compared to the cartoon. Because the cartoon, you know, unfortunately, I mean, the first season of Masters of the Universe, you know, really great, a little more serious. But when the parent groups got involved and said, "Oh, it's devil worship, it's evil," then they had to tone it back for the cartoon and make it maybe a little silly or goofy. And so some of the characters that would normally be more evil couldn't be in the cartoon, but in the mini comics, you definitely could still get it. I mean, because you would never see your grotesque looking Modulok. That would have never happened in the cartoon. You know, it just wouldn't have happened.
No, because they had to deal with a totally different, I won't say different audience, but I guess they have it's a totally different line of critics that could endanger the series if they stepped on someone's wrong toes. It's animation is just so different from comic books in terms of you know, the feedback that you get, and toy companies are very averse to complaints. They're very, you know, because the only thing they want to do is sell toys, and so anything they if they get criticism, they react. Sometimes they overreact. I'll put it that way. And so, really? in animation, you just have to be cognizant of not stepping over the line that a critic could use to the detriment of the series. So, but you know, in comics, it's really, you know, I won't say you can do anything you want, but the limits in comic books are far. The fence around us, I should say, is further. So that's why we can have.
Yeah, you can have more leeway
with the comic books. Yeah.
Yeah, so I figured you might have a little more leeway with the mini comics than your comics, then, correct?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, yeah, that too. You know, until, you know, the one comic that got me in trouble was that He-Man one. It's like
Slave City with the cover.
Slave City. Yeah,
the cover. That Slave City cover. Parents called they called the toy company about that one. Which was interesting, because when I talked to Lee, he said that, you know, when he turned in the cover, the toy people had no problem with it. It got out there. They published it, no problem. They didn't ask for any changes. And it was only when they started getting feedback that I think what Lee told me was that they put something in the toy to block the cover a little bit. And even though they didn't, you know, it was in production, they weren't going to stop production, but I think they put an insert or something to block the cover when it went out in later production.
What was the issue with the cover that they had such a problem with? Because I never seen an issue when I was a kid looking at it. But I mean, for fans who maybe never heard the story, what was the crazy issue?
I'm not sure, because that's a, excuse me, that's a typical comic book cover. You'd see, like, you know, a superhero in bondage and the bad guy's getting ready to do something bad to him. And that's a basic superhero cover. I didn't think anything of it, because it just didn't even enter my mind that someone would find a problem with it. So otherwise I wouldn't have drawn it. I would have done something else. I didn't think anything was wrong with it myself.
He's on his knees. He's had the chains. Battle Cat's. What is he in a net or like? Tyler, do you have the? Yeah, do you have the picture of that cover just to show people, Tyler? Just so in case somebody doesn't remember what the cover is.
Just one second here. I got it right.
Yeah, I don't. Oh, there it is. I have it on the wall.
Oh, you got it there, Larry. Okay.
Yeah, I got it. Let's see if I can walk over to it. Let's see. I have a lot of the books on the wall.
Look at that. So, man, Larry, perfect excuse to go over and see more of Larry's collection up close and personal here.
That's really cool.
I think it's this one here.
Yep, right there.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, so it looks like Battlecat is he's in a net. He-Man is helpless, and the bad guy looks like he's getting ready to bash him with mace or something.
Yeah.
So, maybe adding the mace was a little bit too far. I don't know.
As a kid, like when I came across it, certainly didn't. And it wasn't until I got older and I think read some articles like on He-Man.org that this cover came under scrutiny. So not for once did I ever think. Because I was so used to seeing a lot of this stuff and looking at, I was familiar with Conan as a kid and a lot of other, fantasy depictions. So I guess it was just part of, that time and era where certain parents were coming down on He-Man really hard. And I guess.
Yeah, it was just, it just caught the right person's eye for them to make a big deal about it. So
yeah, those people that make a fuss over something that they know nothing about, like they look at a cover but don't understand the context of what's happening on the mini comic. Like you're like, okay, you seen He-Man didn't get decapitated, nothing else, was bloody, nothing like that happened. They always want to judge. I mean, hell, you can look at any of the covers, any of the comics. It's never made me want to pick up a sword, an axe, shoot somebody with a gun. It's like, what are you talking about? These are stories. I didn't mean to get all worked up, but it just drives me nuts.
Hey, it did the same thing to a lot of us working in the industry of like having to deal with people who think that, kids are monkeys and they're just going to, ooh, there's someone who's going to, there's a human torch. Let me go light myself on fire. It's like, I remember as a kid, watching the old, Tom and Jerry's and the coyote and the Roadrunner and anvils falling on people and the whole nine yards. It's a cartoon, right? It's just fun and funny. That's all it is. It's not real.
Exactly. Well, I'll pass it back to you.
What was real to me was, and I this just like Clash of Arms, I got these two at the exact same time. Christmas 1987 was this one.
Oh wow! Yeah, Hordak.
Talk about a battle royal.
I'm wearing the Hordax logo here in celebration.
Yeah, I see that. It looks cool. Yeah.
And this one, to me, was a big deal because you depicted an ungodly amount of frozen villains in this one book. And, I mean, one of my favorite is this splash page you did.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's one of the kind of things that I tried to do. I tried to pace the story. So because I had so many characters to draw, I needed some full page panels to show all of these characters. And so I try and, that's the thing about pacing. You have the little panels to get to move the story forward, but the big page is for showing, all these characters. And that cover was like, I didn't know how I was going to get all those characters in the cover.
Yeah, the cover is epic as hell. Crap. I mean, it's open and memorable one for me. I mean, just the villains charging in He-Man. And to me, this was evil in its purest form. How you depicted the Horde and Skeletor's warriors, and then they're all fighting each other. I mean, as a kid, just to go back and just watch all these fights. I mean, you've got Spiker, Manyface, Cyclone, and Skeletor. You got Mantana and He-Man, and then you got all the villains. And this was another one of yours. That fight.
Oh God! Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Like, all the fighting
with Whiplash and Grizzlord going at each other. And I mean, it was just, God, it left such an impression. I just would sit and look the ferocity of in Grizzlord and Jitsu looking pissed off. He's going to just, kick the hell out of Leech.
Hell, and even the expression on He-Man's face, the shock of him looking like, oh my God, they're fighting each other.
Watching all this stuff. The shock and every single character in that panel. Except for Roboto, because he's got no emotion on his face there. But everybody is in shock. I mean, and Larry just draws it with perfection. I mean, it's just, I mean, everything is intense. Spikor and Manny Face is duking it out. And the scene of Hordak and Skeletor are over the bonfire, making their truce. You got the Horde members back watching it on. I mean, you're really building up a great atmosphere of these villains meeting. And right. It's just so easy to – and like Larry says, what you're seeing here, I can clearly tell everything that's going on here. Because, well, I had to as a kid because I couldn't read. So right. It was, you know, yeah. At three, I'm just like, okay, I get what's going on here. What you did came through, you know, for a 3-year-old in 1987.
Even from when you talked about the good guys there, how they're looking, you know, shocked at what they're witnessing with seeing two groups of the evil warriors, the factions, fighting. You know, some other artists and some other comics, if they could have drawn it, they could have just had the heroes stand there with absolutely no expression. You wouldn't understand what's going on. But like you said, you're seeing the fight, and when you see the heroes looking like that, it pretty much tells the story that they're like, what in the hell am I witnessing here?
Yeah, that's clarity. You just want to make sure when you draw something, I want to tell the story without words as much as possible and just let the words do the subtext. And so, you know, I remember talking to Lee that there are some fights I wanted to continue, but, you know, if they could have doubled the length of the you know, how many pages, I could have had a lot more fun with the fights, but, you know, you only have so many pages. That would have been fun, right? I had ideas on how to have more fights and you know, back and forth, that type of thing. It is what it is. I only had so many pages to draw, so I had to make the best of what they gave me.
And you did a great job at that.
Oh my God, yes. Oh, thank you. Especially knowing that you could have expanded the villains fighting each other. Like, I'd like to have seen Mantenna and Cobra Khan duking it out more, Whiplash and Grizzlor just clawing at each other. I mean, it just makes me just nauseous knowing you could have done even more.
Could you imagine double issues? Could you picture that, Tyler, double issues of Larry Houston's mini comics back then? That would have been bonkers.
Yeah, oh, I really would have. I'd have paid top dollar. I'd given my allowance every week that I could, or mowed lawns at age 5 to get to make double issues of Larry Houston's work. God almighty.
Yeah, the fights are the ones that I had the most fun choreographing, either in animation or in a comic book, because I could, for some reason, I could see the story very clearly in my mind. And so I knew what I wanted to put down there. And I had to just basically call it, I had to, you know, get rid of stuff and just, okay, let me put down the best scenes here because I only have so many pages. And, you know, that was the other reason why I would take, that's why I did all the small panels, because I wanted to show the action in big panels and have some fun with it, because that's the fun part. You know, I know what it was like to be 8 years old, 9 years old and reading these things. And it's like, that's what I wanted to put in the books. You know, that was my thing, is that when I was working on He-Man and when I was working in animation, I tried to remember what it was like when I was that age and what it was that I thought was cool, what made me excited about the show or the comic book, and then put that into whatever I'm working on and just try and have fun with it, you know, try and make it exciting. If I can make the little boy in me excited about what I'm drawing, then maybe I'm on the right track. And that's what I did a lot of.
Now, with you, you know, being such a Marvel fan and always really loving to work on anything Marvel, from Marvel animation, you know, from like Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends and Pride of the X-Men and the X-Men 90 series. When you're approached with something like this that you really don't have a previous connection to, you know, is it easy for you to kind of sink your teeth into it creatively, or do you kind of have to look at it for a while and think, okay, I think I get this? Or do you look at it and like, okay, we got heroes and villains, big muscular heroes and villains and beautiful women. I can jump right, because this is Marvel Comics essentially.
Well, a lot of my, I started at Filmation and I left Filmation just before He-Man started. So my friends were still working at Filmation on the show. And so we would go to lunch, we'd talk, we got to the movies together back then. And so I was very familiar with He-Man. I just wasn't working on the show. And so when I got approached to doing the comic book, it was like, hey, this is great. It's almost like working with my buddies, you know? So I was familiar with the show, but just I didn't work on it. I was doing Spider-Man or whatever I was working on at the time. So no, it, I what so yeah, He-Man I wanted to work on. It was, if I had stayed at Filmation, I probably would have worked on the series.
Wow. Yeah, because you're also responsible for the most unique looking version of Teela, also from the Secret Liquid of Life that you did. That version of Teela has never been shown in any of the other comics. You know, like we've seen her with a cobra armor before and how she looks in Filmation, but I didn't know if you remembered how she looked. And it's like a, well, let me see if I can possibly. Oh, you do? Because I was going to say, I didn't know if you could see this Teela or if I'm not close enough.
Oh, the one where she's like fighting with the sword?
Yeah.
Where she's fighting with the sword. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the most unique Teela that we've never seen. So, again, I mean, I didn't know what, like, you know, what they were telling you, like if they were trying to say, go buy this action figure. I couldn't even remember if the cartoon was still being in development at the time, but I just know it was cool and it was memorable to see this kind of Teela and like maybe what was the thought process when you came up with her.
I just wanted to get her into, I just made up the outfit because I wanted her to have enough freedom of movement so that, you know, she's like slicing and dicing like a He-Man or like a Conan character. So I wanted her to have more freedom. So I just kind of like, you know, gave her a different outfit so she could have some, it sort of looked more believable that she could get in combat and stuff. So yeah, I think I made it up.
Oh, you definitely did. That's your Teela. This is a unique Teela. Yeah. I mean, you might as well say that's Larry Houston's Teela because nobody else has ever done that version. And it's memorable and it's cool. That's why I love knowing, you know, behind scenes stuff of what, you know, people are thinking when they come up with a different look. And I love it.
Oh, thank you. Did I continue that design throughout the book? Because I don't have it in front of me.
Nope. You mean in this book itself? You kept it. Yeah, she had that same
look.
Yeah, she retained the look within this book. I thought at first you meant in other future comics, but no, she kept that design through the entire mini comic. Yeah.
Oh, good. I'm glad I was consistent.
Yeah, no, it's not like you drew her like that, and then the next one she had the cobra armor. It was consistent.
Okay, that's good. That's good.
You touched on this on the first interview, Larry, and I'd love for you to tell listeners who haven't heard that one yet. Geldor gets essentially sucked up into, you know, the Tree of Life at the end. Could you tell fans when you drew that what your idea for Geldor was? You know, did you see him as dying? Did you see it as something else? I mean, you've already told us once, but I'm asking you to reiterate. Because me and Jason talked about what you had in mind for him as if, like, God almighty, man. I'll let you say it first before you.
I think I don't remember what I said before, but I think the intention was, you know, he gets, the Tree of Life is growing and he's getting sucked up in it. And in my mind, he's in there somewhere waiting for a wizard to get him out.
And I love that you said that because that's been a big debate because when I brought that question up in the, you know, first time we had you on, I brought it up because I see debates a lot and I've seen the debates of people saying either that tree consumed him, so he's dead, he's gone. And some people said, oh, he's just sitting on the top of the tree. So that's why we had to bring it up last time. And you said that he's within the tree, like magically in there, and maybe a wizard with a spell can bring him out and Geldor could be unleashed. You know, that would be amazing, especially if there was ever a return. Like if they started doing mini comics again for like, because Super 7, as I told you before, they're now starting to do 5.5-inch figures. Like, you know, the old days, not just, you know, the classic big ones you've been seeing, but the smaller ones. I thought, hell, it would be a genius idea that if they were ever to finally give us a vintage style Geldor, that maybe if they don't do a mini comic or whatever, but if they could even do a, you know, a fake faux cover, that you gotta be the one drawing it with Geldor busting through and it says Geldor Unleashed or Geldor's Return. It's like, I'd piss my pants.
I would love to draw that because that's I can actually see the cover of my head just as you said that. You know, I can see him bursting out saying, I'm back, you know, Geldor's back, and he's mad as hell or something like that.
You know? Oh, my God, man.
We got a campaign for stuff, Tyler. I'm telling you, because first, I'm just going to let you know, Larry, in the chat, having everybody saying, I buy it, I want it, I need it. So I'm going to let you know, we're going to make a hype. I'll hype the hell out of this. It needs to happen. But definitely if they were to have mini comics return, whether it's full ones or covers, you need to return too. We got to have you back. And even fans like one of the fans in the chat room, JSP, says, any chance of you appearing at PowerCon this year?
I haven't been invited. And I think I went to the first two. I haven't been invited to the last ones, but if you can talk to the guys and see if they want me to come by, I'll stop by, because it's about an hour away from my house. I can stop by.
Oh Jesus! Well, yeah, we're gonna have to drop and pass that along. I mean, there's no doubt that's what we're gonna do. They have you come back, and hell, if we could drum up some rumblings of a book or anything in interest, and see what fans think. It's stuff that gets us pumped up. It ain't just me and Tyler. Sometimes we're the voice for everybody, and so we're expressing it and getting too excited. But trust me, everybody else feels like this. We just get to vent it towards you.
Okay, well, thank you. Yeah, get some people who want me to show up, and I'll come on down there. Sure. I'm gonna actually walk downstairs because my phone just told me I had 15% power, so I got to plug this thing into an outlet. Okay.
Yeah. And when you do go, if you end up going to PowerCon, that's going to be something that maybe you can bring up or ask fans, like, hey, would you be interested in seeing an Art of Larry Houston book and behind-the-scenes stuff? And
some of the old toys.
Oh, look. Yeah. There he goes. Secret He's on
Wars.
His tour.
You got Secret Wars over there, man.
Yeah. I got all those.
The tour of his wow.
Is that an entire collection of superpowers you have?
Yeah, I got them all. I think
every single one of them.
Yeah.
Oh man, he's even got Cyborg, Men on Card.
Yeah.
Black Star. Look at the Black Star figures. He's got Men on Card.
I do. Oh yeah, that's right.
Look, Batman movie figures, Police Academy. Oh,
Larry's like, that's nothing. He's like, I got everything. I said, shoot, I got this. I got that. That's awesome.
But
that's
a collector from the Marvel Universe. That's what he is. He's got it all right in the room.
Yeah. Sometimes what they would do is that they would give us free toys when we worked on the show. And so I would take the toys and I just wouldn't open them. I just pin them on a wall. I know it's dark. You can't see me.
Oh, no, you're fine. You're fine.
It's all right. We're having your version of the Blair Witch Project. We're going through. We're seeing.
Okay, let me go over here.
Just don't start screaming and running, then we'll be a little freaked out.
All right, I better go upstairs. My wife's cooking. She's going to turn on something. Let me go back upstairs again.
I'll take your time, man.
No, but like I said, Larry, when you do go to PowerCon, if you did end up going, I'm sure if you did ask a question of if fans would be interested in a Art of Larry Houston book and behind-the-scenes stuff, I'm sure you'll be overwhelmed with probably hearing the reaction, and hopefully that would pique the interest of maybe that, happening, and something maybe could go forward with that.
I'd love to do it, just gotta, on the, if there's interest, I'd love to revisit the character.
Well, spread the word. We're gonna spread the word of everything, not only of working on possible new comics or covers or anything, but just the art book of all the stuff that you've done in the past and things that we haven't seen, because just you saying that you have some things in storage, that possibly are things that we've never, ever seen before. Fans like that. We always like behind-the-scenes stuff and unseen things. So it's
okay, definitely... I got to put you down for a second.
Oh, you're fine.
That's all right. We'll look at the ceiling. No problem.
The ceiling's going to flip over, and he has an entire Men on Card collection of He-Man and G.I. Joe.
He's got it all. He puts my collection to shame. It's like nothing. I have the same view every week of this in back of me. It's nothing.
All right. Got it plugged in.
All right. Joe, does the fans have any questions in the chat room?
Well, let's see, because I would probably have to scroll up a little bit. Well, Eric Amon in the chat room said, he's realizing that it's a Masters of the Universe-focused interview. He said, but it'd be awesome to know, Larry, what work, whether in animation or otherwise, in your portfolio, are you the most proud of?
For me, it was working on the X-Men.
Yeah.
And part of it, the reason I say that one is because that's the one that I tell people that I had the least amount of adult supervision on. they kind of left me alone, and I kind of did the show I wanted to do. And so I got to – sorry, I'm this little court. Hold on a second.
Okay.
No, it was let's see. I'm trying to make sure this thing is charging. Okay. It's giving me some weird message. All right. Let me see if this works.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Well, I think you were it was the X-Men so far, was the one I had the most freedom with. And also I have to say it was the He-Man comics too, because they let me do what I wanted. They let me create characters. They let me pace the stories the way I wanted to. And that's pretty much the freedom I had on the X-Men. So, I guess both of those shows, the He-Man comics and the X-Men comic books, X-Men TV show,
okay,
will probably be the two things that I like the best out of all the productions I've worked on.
Okay. All right. And, another question from Andy Yelsey in the chat room. He said, why did they stop giving the writer, penciler, inker credit in the mini comics? He says, the early ones seemed like they showed the credits, but it seems like they stopped, from Temple of Darkness, and then they stopped in some of the others. Did you ever know why some comics didn't seem like they gave credit to everybody?
I'm not sure. That was, let me get this thing going. If ever you can get Lee Norling to do an interview, that was mainly he was in charge of making sure that little credit box was there. Sometimes when I was drawing, I would put a little box there so that the letterer could write in, who wrote this, who could give the credits there. And sometimes I would turn in the work probably knowing that the letterer would include everything like it did in the previous episodes, previous issues.
Okay.
And I'm assuming that maybe because I didn't draw the box, nobody put the credits in, which I find strange. But that would be a Lee Nordling thing to talk to him about and see why stuff like that didn't happen.
Yeah, that would be interesting to find out. But all right, well, thank you for that. And Zentron in the chat room, he just had a little comment. He said, annoyingly, he said, the X-Men animated series or X-Men animated is edited here in the UK. So I didn't know if you knew about that in the UK. I guess apparently they edited the X-Men animated.
I did not know that, but it doesn't surprise me because when I also worked on, I did 114 episodes of the Ninja Turtles.
Okay.
And when that series went overseas, they edited it too, and they called it Teenage Mutant Hero Turtles.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, so they did change things when it went overseas. For some reason, ninja was a bad word or something back then or whatever. So I could see them editing X-Men, but no, I did not know.
Yeah, I wouldn't even wonder. I mean, because he didn't, specify in the chat room, but could you even imagine what possibly would have been edited from that? I couldn't even picture what would they have edited from that cartoon.
Wow. I wish I knew. The only person I can think of would be, I don't know. We had a lot of combat. My first choice would be Wolverine, obviously, but we had elements that are basically part of a regular drama that to me never stepped over the line. But when you're dealing with European standards, their criteria is so different so different from America. God, I would have no idea.
Well, I mean, could be Sabretooth slashes Wolverine's ribs in, I think, Deadly Reunion. Sabretooth has been, he's been locked up in the Xavier's mansion. Jubilee lets him out, and then they start duking, and then he slashes Wolverine. And I had to double check. and I'm like, I think I'm pretty sure that that was blood animated on Wolverine's ribs. Like, just real quickly, I'm fairly certain.
It might have been, but
it wasn't focused on just like small detail.
Yeah, we had to be real careful because Wolverine's power is to, to gut people and stab people, and so we had to have him miss quite a bit. Unless he was fighting a robot, then he could just go crazy.
Wow. So, and, here's a couple other little interesting things about the Ninja Turtles from some of the fans in the chat room. Grimbot said, in Germany, not only was it Hero Turtles, but they also added a bunch of wacky, cheesy sound effects to action scenes to make them goofy. So I didn't know if you knew that.
Oh, my God. Well, that's one way that to tone down the violence is to add. Yeah, that's one way they could do it. So it didn't seem as dramatic as before. It's just,
It would have been painful to see that. If I couldn't imagine watching that in the States like that. Because then Zentron in the chat room also said they even edited out Michelangelo's nunchucks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my God. You really? Wow.
That's terrible. Oh, it's terrible. The edits that happen in for some of these cartoons and things in other countries and just whatever. I guess it just depends. But, wow, I could not picture that.
Neither could I. I was like, that's a lot of work to take them out of a show, because what did they replace it with? Unless there are things called back then. There was a thing called Verispeed, where if you did take a scene out and the scene was like maybe a foot and a half of film, you could Verispeed the entire show to compensate for the lack of that scene being taken out. But if you're going to take out several scenes, you're talking about trying to Verispeed an entire show. And then what that does, suddenly the voices go for it and start talking like that. You start hearing the pitch change in the entire show, because now the whole show's, it's going faster than before. So that's problematic for them to do that. But if they did it, well, they did it. We had no control over that.
I couldn't even imagine calling them the Hero Turtles. It's one of those bizarre things to think that ninja would be considered something bad in other countries, or maybe they were scared of what it might promote. But here, that's what we always have known them as. That's what they are. It's just, again, it's what we, touched on earlier, of just things, whether it's from parents complaining or certain countries don't like certain things. But to me, it's always bizarre. As long as you tell your kids, this is our cartoons, these are comics, it's make-believe, don't do what you're seeing, then things should be fine. As long as you're telling your kids right from wrong, anybody should know not to emulate things.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And the stuff I grew up with was, I knew it was entertaining. And I don't think we did anything that would endanger a child. I don't know. Maybe I'm just the exception to the rule, but I just saw that, it's a cartoon,
Right. You were never trying to drop an anvil or rocks or things. Or it's like, who does that? Oh, boy. Well, I'll pass it to Tyler, because I know eventually we'll wrap this up, because we've hit you with tons of things here, and we got, a lot of things that definitely we'll be promoting for you, and hopefully things that'll be coming up soon and maybe can work to something great. Let's hope.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have any projects or anything you're currently working on right now that fans could be, checking out and help support that you're working on right now?
Before I got into animation, I was part of the, I used to draw comics for my own pleasure. When I was in high school, my friends and I, we would draw our own version of the Avengers, our own version of the Justice League, whatever. We'd have fun with it. And I drew about 3 issues of a comic book I made up called The Enforcers, which was a superhero group back then. And I did 3 issues, because then I got hired at Filmation, and that's it. That was it. I got real money, and so I stopped working on it. I'm in the process of taking those old books and running it through Photoshop and cleaning it up. I'm going to put that out as a graphic novel, and then I'm going to put it out. Then I'm going to do some new material for it. And so the other thing I'm working on a children's book for very young kids, like 5 to 7, that very young age. And I'm developing. That's right. I wrote a screenplay that I'm going to try and turn into a graphic novel.
Wow.
And working with some other artists. So I'm trying to stay busy. I took about a year off. I semi-retired last year. And so now I'm trying to get back to doing some work and keep the creative juices flowing. And so, you know, I'm trying to stay relevant and have fun.
Well, when you have any of these ready to be, you know, I mean, when they're published and they're ready to be sold, I mean, you let us know. We'll give the links. We'll spread it everywhere to let people know where to go and where to get your stuff. I mean, it's definitely, because I'm sure fans would definitely be interested. I know me and Tyler are already ready to say, here's our money. Take it.
Well, thank you, guys. I appreciate the support. Yeah, thank you.
Are these things that you're looking to sell online? Are you doing like a Kickstarter or anything for fan support? Or is it just strictly to be available in like your local Barnes & Noble? You know, what will be the route to purchase this stuff?
Right now, I'm working to set up a deal with Comicology. So I met some of the executives who work there. So I'm going to get the book initially through them as an online comic. And I'm trying to work out the logistics for having it printed, a physical copy to print out for everyone.
Oh yeah, we'd love a physical.
Yeah, well, we always love it. Know how that goes, so we can you know, me and Joe could spread the word on that. That way we can get our own copy of that, whether it's online or the actual, you know, hard copy of it too. Let us know when, you know, keep us in the loop on that, because we would genuinely like to spread the word on that and post on all the various He-Man pages. You know, hey, you know, the guy who drew Clash of Arms, he's still got more stuff coming, man. Let's buy more of it here.
Okay, I could do that. And thank you. And I will do my due diligence and try and locate all that He-Man stuff that's sitting in the storage somewhere. My wife keeps telling me, why are you paying for storage? Clear the storage out. And, you know, honestly, I'm not a hoarder. I was just lazy. I just put stuff in a box and put it over there, and I just kept working to make more money, you know. So by accident, I'm a hoarder, or I keep stuff. And, you know.
No, we just say you like the keeper of the greatest secrets. That's what you are. That there is no, unless you're a heroic hoarder, like to tie in, like, you know, evil hoard. You're the heroic hoard here. Yeah, that's what Larry is.
Definitely, and always know that people appreciate the stuff, because I know that, you know, sometimes, you know, working on things in the past, and there was a lot of artists that, you know, we've talked to before, sometimes they didn't think maybe things they drew would be important years later. Nobody really cared. Well, you could tell the way we're talking, how the fans are replying, and plus how things have changed nowadays, how people love collecting and seeing stuff. Yeah. We definitely appreciate want to see. So it's glad, and we're glad you're a hoarder. We're definitely glad you're a hoarder. You kept that stuff, because there's probably some good lost treasures there that we all need to see. So, but I'll pass it back to you, Tyler, and then, like I said, you could wrap it up, and yeah, I'll pass it to you, Tyler.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Larry too, and since we've got you here too, and you know, I had such a blast with you, me and Doug, asking about the X-Men animated series and your various projects working for Marvel Animation. Joe and I and my buddy Nathan have started up another podcast where we do commentaries for superhero cartoons.
Right.
And
it's
going to be one that we hit a lot. And I wanted to ask you if you had ever had some free time to sit down with us and just record a fan commentary for some of your choice episodes, like the Juggernaut, Night of the Sentinels, Cold Vengeance, any of the Phoenix Saga, any of just as a fun, like we just, you know, with no sound, but we would just watch it together and just pick your brain and let you share like a little behind the scenes insight on the episodes as we would watch it together.
Oh, that would be kind of fun. Cause actually, I was at WonderCon and myself and the story editors, and we got kind of a variation on that question, in that people wanted to know how come we weren't part of the, like a commentary track where we could talk about the show. And we basically said, you know, nobody asked us, but that was something we all wanted to do. And being a part of that would be kind of fun, because, you know, when I watched the shows, you know, later on, it's like I remember stuff. Oh, yeah, I did this. I did that. I did this. You know, there are little parts that once you see it again, it brings back the memories of the production and what I did at certain things, things I changed, things I added. There are a lot of little, what I call course corrections that I did to the scripts, I did to the art, to make sure that the show was accurate to the books. I did a lot of that. I did a lot of stuff like that most people don't know about. I just kind of like trying to make the show as good as I can make it, you know, that kind of stuff. So yeah, no, I'd love to be a part of that. That'd be kind of fun.
Oh no, I mean, we, you know, cause we did one on our first Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. We did Firestar Is Born.
Okay.
Yeah. We did that one yesterday. And I told them when we started this, like, well, we have to do X-Men. And I told Joe and Nathan, like, I really hope we could get Larry to join us, because I just felt like it would just be letting you cut loose and talk the entire episode. And if we could record like a couple with you at a time and just promote the hell out of it. This is the guy responsible for the X-Men 90 series. Here's his thoughts as you're watching Night of the Sentinels Part 2 or The Unstoppable Juggernaut or, you know, The Final Decision. I mean, God, there's so many episodes I'd love to just, you just have it. It's Mike is yours. You just sit and let us just geek out of what you have to say about these episodes, the depiction of the characters. You know, I mean, that I think that'd be a blast for not just us, but for fans to just get all this insight from you.
I would love to do that. And funny you mentioned that episode of Firestorm Is Born, because I did act 3 of that show.
I thought you were, and I'm curious, I thought you had to have had something, because I touched on that a little bit as we were recording it. And I'm like, I bet Larry has something to do with this, as aside from, you know, all the heavy X-Men stuff. The storyline of Spider-Man fighting Juggernaut, which was reminiscent of Amazing Spider-Man around that time when he had that 2-part story.
Yes.
Fighting. Are you responsible for kind of pushing that we need to kind of incorporate that storyline as well? And then getting all the, like the Magneto cameo and the Sentinel cameo.
That was all me.
I knew it had to be like, it's like I got Larry's fingers all over this episode.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a fun episode. That was written by my friend Christy Marks. And I think I either did a third or I did a half of the show, because I remember quite a bit of it. Or at least visually, I remember quite a bit of it. But I definitely told my friends, I said, look, I need to do Act 3. I want Act 3. So I told them. So I either got Act 3 or I got the second half of the show. And that's what I worked on. That's what I did. And that was a lot of fun, because part of what I wanted to do also was trying to show, we only had 3 networks back then. And I wanted to show how dynamic the X-Men could be by showing how exciting it could be that maybe we could get them interested in the show. This was prior to the X-Men, because I was one of the guys who worked on that. And so, yeah, I made sure to do that section.
And you probably were also responsible for the X-Men Adventure episode too, which was heavy.
Yes.
As well. Yes. Yeah.
Since you just saw it, I think at the end of the episode, I think was the characters were holding up like a soda bottle.
We were thinking milk or soda. We were talking about that very.
What was it?
The networks forced us to. They didn't want us. They didn't want the kids to be. They didn't want us to imply that they were drinking. Liquor, so we had to design something that looks like a Coca-Cola bottle and put it in their hands.
Okay, because that's awesome. Like they're all drinking soda together.
I sat there when I was watching too, I was like, I think they're all drinking milk. It looked like white bottles, like a big, nice, cold bottle of white milk. I was like, you know, Spider-Man was like, brought to you by milk. You know,
they made us draw something very specific so they didn't look like they were. You know, drinking beer or drinking wine or whatever. So it's like, they were so overreacting. So that's what I came from.
That's funny that it came up. We just discussed that just yesterday.
Fantastic.
The reason I remember that, because I had to draw it. And that's the only reason. It's like, oh, God. Really? Fine. Okay. I'll draw these stupid little bottles in here.
See, this is what we want for these commentaries. We want to hear these kinds of stories, like the story behind the bottle. That's a fascinating story. That's a story right there. Just hearing that kind of those tidbits.
Yeah. when I watch the episodes, it's like, oh yeah, I remember that. They had us put in this stupid thing here, or oh yeah, I changed this to this, and you know. When I see stuff, I can remember stuff better, you know.
It's just so, funny to hear that there's an actual story behind that. We were rambling about those bottles just yesterday. Now to know there's an actual story behind the bottles. I mean, it's crazy. Out of all the details, it's fascinating.
Yeah, BS&P, Broadcast Standards and Practices. They were always inconsistent in what they wanted us to do or not do. You just couldn't predict what they were going to find offensive, quote unquote. You know, and we had to change this. Or change that and stuff. Yeah. I'm glad I don't have to deal with that anymore.
There you go. All right. Well, Larry, we definitely, like I said, we've just loved this interview. I mean, definitely we'd have to do it again. And I wanted to thank everybody that joined us in the chat room and hope you enjoyed it because, you know, they gave you some questions. They just have been enjoying the hell out of you. So it just shows, like I said, the more interest of having you back and in any of the projects you work on. So it's been a pleasure, but I'll pass it to Tyler so he can wrap it up and with anything he'd want to say. And thank you again.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
I can't stress it enough. I mean, it's always so much fun communicating with you through email and getting these things set up and just talking to you. Cause it's a shame. We can't do this in person cause it would be like a nice 12-hour documentary about the career of Larry Houston. I mean, it really could, you know. But, I mean, thank you so much for doing this. And really, I really would love to have you for our X-Men commentaries on our other podcast that we call Capes and Commentaries, just all superhero cartoons.
I'd love to do that. We would
love to set some time up to just record however in many episodes you would have time to do, and we would just make those individual episodes. So I'll be in touch on that and find out when you get some free time to record a few of those.
Okay, that's fine. And I'll be in touch with you also about, as I discovered the He-Man art,
yes,
I'll put it out there so you guys can see it and see who wants it.
That and along with your Enforcers book and your graphic novels, send us the info and we'll spread it like wildfire. We'll do it for free because we love you to death, Larry. We can't praise you enough for what you've done. And on behalf of all the fans, we thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Well, tell everyone, thank you for liking the material and liking what I did. And like I said, back then there was no Facebook, there was no internet. So we're pretty much flying by the seat of my pants and just trying to do good work for the audience, for the kids out there, for the fans. And I'm glad it worked.
Oh, it definitely did. You did a great job. Yes. So thank you again, Larry. We hope to have you here again and we're going to promote the hell out of everything you got.
All right, sir. Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Right. Take care, Larry.
Okay. Bye-bye. See you.